Years ago, my wife and I bought a rundown house, and the neighbors told us a story about a mattress that somebody had left in the backyard. It had become a home for rodents before the neighbors finally dragged it away. Turns out it's not easy to dispose of an old mattress. Most recyclers won't touch them, and landfills would rather not. But a business born as a class project in Nashville provides a solution and creates jobs for former convicts. Here's Blake Farmer of our member station WPLN.
Even the best machines can only chew up mattresses. Recycling requires manual labor. Ron Harness runs his box cutter around a queen-size bed to fillet the fabric.
As you can see, this can become labor-intensive.
Harness rips off a cotton sheet, peels away the layer of foam, and shoves the steel springs into a baler. Harness literally has deconstructing a mattress and box springs down to a science. It keeps one eye on a stopwatch.
It's actually 7.62 minutes on a mattress is my average, and 5.03 minutes on a box.
Efficiency is the key to this enterprise called Springback. Otherwise, there's not a ton of competition for used mattresses, even though they contain an average of 25 pounds of steel and foam that can be chopped up for carpet padding. Recycling companies usually just say no. Bobby Bandy is the founder of Earth Savers.
They've always been viewed as something you can't tackle. It needs to go in the landfill, and the landfill guys don't want it.
Unlike other trash, mattresses don't easily pack down. More than a dozen states do have at least one recycler, but they're usually small in scale. So most mattresses find their way to landfills, according to an industry trade group. A few beds are diverted from the dump by being reused, says Andrew Bloomfield with Mattresses Unlimited.
We partner with several people who remove mattresses and reconstitute them into new product.
Those would be old springs that get a new cover and are sold in discount showrooms. But instead of feeding into the used mattress market, Bloomfield's company, which operates in five states, is now trying out Springback. Salesmen are playing up the partnership, telling customers their old bed will be recycled. If the environmental benefits aren't enough, an ex-convict will be doing the work.
It's not going to cooperate.
With a pair of pliers, Ron Harness begins yanking 1,000 coils out of a king-size bed. He's helped refine the recycling process, but just a few months ago, he was behind bars for a serious misdemeanor charge.
Didn't know where I was going to go. The street was an option.
Providing meaningful employment for hard-to-hire workers is where this venture doubles down on its social mission. The business plan from students at Nashville's Belmont University took first place in a national competition. Part of the $10,000 prize became seed money.
This is, in my opinion, very rare and very unique.
Belmont finance professor John Gonis has taken the reins of the startup. Like most new for-profit businesses, he says very few social enterprises succeed.
We've actually tried lots of different things. We had a sewing project one year that didn't work with refugees.
The women from Burundi made beautiful pillows, just not fast enough. This charitable business, on the other hand, is approaching an all-important break-even point when revenues cover the operating costs. Gonis says he hopes to license the model in other cities and get springbacks popping up all over the country. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
From Colorado to California, the snowpack is the lowest it's been in decades. It's been a mild winter, which is bad for powder skiers and snow-dependent businesses, but that's not the big deal. Kirk Sigler of member station KUNC reports the weather is also a concern for millions of people who depend on melting snow for drinking water and farms.
Maggie Skordal shields her eyes from the unforgiving high-altitude sun as she snowshoes into a snowtell monitoring station. It's on Berthoud Pass at 11,000 feet along the Continental Divide.
This site gets used for basin averages for the Upper Colorado.
Hydrologists have been visiting this site taking snow depth samples for 60 years. Skordal, who works for the Natural Resources Conservation Service, uses a hollow metal tube and drops it into the snow at precise locations.
Yeah, 8 inches of water.
Gauging the depth and water content here is important because much of this snow will melt and flow into the Colorado River, eventually winding its way to taps from Denver to Los Angeles. Think of it like a virtual storage reservoir.
In the western states, about 75% of our water supply comes from the snowpack. That's a lot.
So when the snowpack here at the headwaters of an arid region comes in at just over half of normal, time to take notice.
Can we recover from this? Yeah. You know, we still have a lot of season left, but, you know, it's not a good start.
Well, the big thing that I've heard our engineers say is if we have to have a dry year, which we're never excited about, this is a great year to have it.
70 miles east up and over the Continental Divide is Dana Strongen's office at Northern Water. Her agency pumps melted snow through a maze of pipes and reservoirs that feed thirsty cities and farms in northeastern Colorado. Strongen says she's not worried yet because last winter was so snowy.
But if this year lags and next year lags, yeah, we can lose levels in our reservoirs and get a little concerned. A good portion of the 2000s was pretty rough on our storage.
So it's not a crisis yet if you're in the water business, but recreation? I'm standing here at the base of the Winter Park Ski Resort watching a few snowboarders and skiers slide into the lift. And like many western ski resorts, Winter Park has been left pretty high and dry so far this year. And resort spokeswoman Mista Lynn Lee says they haven't actually been making snow here since December.
We're in the industry of Mother Nature.
Barely a third of the mountain here is open. Nearby Vail has attributed a 15% drop in skier visits to the dismal snow. The situation is worse in Lake Tahoe. Just about the only resorts doing well are Taos, New Mexico, and Whistler, British Columbia. The jet stream has sent the big storms to the far north and south. But here in Winter Park, Mista Lynn Lee hasn't given up on winter.
This is very early still in the season, but we have 4 months left of our season, and our busiest month is, snowiest month, is in March.
The ski industry is good at sounding optimistic in dry winters like this, since in Colorado alone, skiing generates about $3 billion a year.
Yeah, we do okay. So we have avalanche beacons with us, shovels.
Back on Berthoud Pass, a popular jumping-off point for backcountry skiers, Helene Storch and Rob Thorsheim are unloading their gear from the back of their Subaru.
Normally, you'd have 3-4 foot snowbanks all around here, and we've got 2-foot snowbanks.
Yeah, last year in January, you couldn't even read that sign. It was covered.
The two are a little more candid than the officials when it comes to the snowfall so far this year. They say it's been depressing. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Sigler.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've talked many times about the rise of drug-resistant bacteria, germs that resist most antibiotics except for a precious few. A case in point is tuberculosis. But now comes word of a strain of TB that is totally drug-resistant. TDR-TB, as doctors are calling it. There are no second-choice antibiotics here. We simply have no drugs to fight this superbug. There are no weapons left, and it has now infected a dozen patients in India. How did this strain originate, and if our drugs don't work anymore, what can doctors do, if anything, and what kind of threat does it, well, does it pose to us or the rest of the people around the world? Here to talk about it is Marion McKenna. She is the author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. She also writes the Superbug blog for Wired, where this story appeared. She joins us by phone. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Marion, tell us about this. It sounds pretty scary, this new superbug.
You know, I have to say I find this chilling, and it's a little complicated. The way this came to light is that immediately before Christmas, so almost everyone missed it at the time, including me, a couple of physicians in Mumbai wrote a letter to a medical journal describing four patients they have with what they called totally drug-resistant TB, which means, as you said, that none of the first-line drugs and none of the second-line drugs, that's more than a dozen drugs altogether, nothing worked. These people had just were uncurable. The Indian media jumped on this story and got the hospital to admit that there actually were 12 patients. They just happened to have complete histories for four. Now, over the next couple of days, it turns out that TDR-TB was actually seen before. In 2009, in 15 patients in Iran, I've spoken to the Iranian physicians. No one's quite sure what happened to those folks. And there were also two cases in Italy who both died in 2003. So it's clearly been popping up for a while, but it looks like this Indian cluster is the one that may be the most, the best documented, and it's certainly the one causing the most concern.
Marin, do we know how this originated or how it started?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the problem. So, you know, when we talk about antibiotic resistance, and as you and I have talked before, there are all kinds of things that can contribute to that. Misuse of antibiotics in agriculture, misuse in sort of everyday medicine. What's going on here with this TB very clearly is that it's an artifact created by poor medical care and poor use of drugs. These people in India, at least, and certainly in the other cases, were not correctly diagnosed to start with. They were given the wrong drugs. They weren't given the right length of drugs, and even at the best of times, MDR-TB, or highly resistant TB, is difficult to treat. And they were sort of kind of natural laboratories for the emergence of a totally resistant strain.
So how fearful should we be that this strain will permeate around the world?
So, you know, this is a sort of plus-minus proposition because on the one hand, it's really troubling to have something like this because we live in such a globalized society where people move back and forth from the industrialized world to the developing world through different economies, and diagnostic tools for TB are really not good. So you might think that someone has everyday TB and they might have a resistant form. The other side of that is that TB is not that easy to catch. It's not like measles. You don't catch TB by just walking past someone on the street. You have to be in close contact with them. But I'll say the third thing that really makes my jaw drop is that literally as I was waiting for this phone line to come live, a bulletin moved across the wire that there were two more cases of TDR-TB in another hospital in a different part of India. They were being held in confinement in the hospital, and one of them has gone missing.
One of the patients has gone missing?
One of the patients has skipped out, probably understandably, because they these drugs are not pleasant to take, and they cause a lot of side effects. You have to take them for a very long time, and it's probably not very pleasant being treated as a public health criminal. So one of these patients has checked himself out of the hospital and disappeared.
So we don't know where that – an infectious patient with the strain of totally drug-resistant TB.
Correct.
Is missing. Wow. What would we do in this country? What are they doing in India to find that person or to stop it from spreading?
Well, I think the Indian government is really kind of struggling with this, and it must be said that the media in India have really jumped on this story and are really pushing it forward, which I think is just fantastic, because of course, you know, as has been seen in other countries with other profound infectious diseases, there's a lot of stigma associated with a situation like this where your country suddenly gets identified with a deadly disease. So the Indian media are pushing the government to try to articulate its plans, but the reality is India is a pretty under-resourced society when it comes particularly to healthcare because of the size of its population and the differential between the rich and the poor. It does not have the diagnostic tools that are needed. It's actually quite difficult to diagnose resistant TB as opposed to plain TB.
So what do you do to treat these people? Or is it back to the old sanitarium pre-antibiotic days? You put people out, isolate them, quarantine them, and hope they get better?
Well, if you think back a couple of years ago when people started to be concerned about MDR-TB, that's TB resistant just to the first-line drugs, there were a couple of cases that came into the United States and public health authorities held them essentially in isolation. That what's supposed to happen is that until you are deemed non-infectious while you've been in drug treatment, if you have one of these highly infectious, highly resistant forms, you are supposed to be confined in some manner. But, you know, if you asked a public health person, do we have enough isolation rooms and hospitals in this country to contain a major epidemic, we already know from worrying about highly infectious flu that we don't have enough isolation rooms. We certainly don't have enough to contain a major TB epidemic.
So everybody's going to be watching to see if this spreads, and in the meantime, the Indian government will be looking for this missing patient.
I think that people are really concerned about what happens next, because as one of the physicians who brought this to light to start with a couple of days ago admitted, what they have identified is just the tip of the iceberg, and really no one is sure how big the rest of that iceberg is.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can get a quick question in from a listener. Let's go to Jared in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Jared.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a documentary some time ago about the Soviet bacteriophage program, where they cultured different bacteriophages that would specifically attack different disease-causing bacteria. It appeared that that program really shut down with the fall of the Soviet Union, but I was wondering if that technology still offers any promise for treatment.
So that's a really interesting question. A couple of things within that. The first is that the phage program did not completely shut down, though it ceased to be state-supported. And I believe there's still a phage program in the state of Georgia, not the state of Georgia I'm sitting in, but the state of Georgia in the former Soviet Union. But whether phages are effective against tuberculosis is something I really know nothing about.
Yeah. But it's an interesting question, Jared, about using phages, because there's a phage for every kind of bacteria, isn't there?
That's what the documentary indicated, yeah. And I was wondering if that was a possibility in this case.
All right. That's an interesting possibility. Thanks for calling. 1-800-999-8255. So how do we wrap up this story? Is this a hopeful story, Marin, or are we just fearful now?
I think it's reasonable to be fearful. I don't think we should be panicked. I think we should be paying attention to the lessons that are embedded within this story. There are a couple of them. The first is the sort of one of my favorite themes, which is, where are the new drugs? Because the reason that we're so scared about highly drug-resistant TB is because there's no new drug coming along. The drugs that we rely on for TB control, in fact, a lot of bacterial control these days, are about 50 years old, because it's not cost-effective for pharmaceutical companies to make antibiotics. The second is, we have to be aware that we need much better diagnostic tools. You know, it can take weeks to grow TB out in culture to figure out if it's susceptible. But there are some new diagnostic techniques, molecular diagnostic techniques, that could help and make that faster if developing world economies could afford them. And the third is, we just have to be aware that really we're all vulnerable at any time. Borders don't protect us. These kind of diseases move back and forth across borders without being detected. And we're really only, as so many public health authorities always say, we're only a plane ride away from anything.
All right. Thank you, Marin.
Thank you.
Marin McKenna is author of Superbug, The Fatal Menace of MRSA. She also writes the Superbug blog for Wired, where you can find this story. And it first appeared, and then she joined us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Thinking about a tattoo? Well, forget butterflies, unicorns, or mom. Tattoos have gone geek. No more of those blurry anchors and pinup girls. We've got molecules, double helix strands, mathematical equations all showing up on biceps and other places. Need some inspiration for your science-themed tattoo? You can find ideas in a new book called Science Inc., Tattoos of the Science Obsessed, a collection of tattoos. You can check out some images on our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the SciArts tab on Science Friday. Or you can share with Carl Zimmer. He's the author of a book here, Science Inc., Tattoos of the Science Obsessed. He's with me here in our New York studios. Thanks for coming in, Carl.
Oh, thanks for having me.
How did the idea of the science of tattoos, all these science-related tattoos, come up?
Well, one day I just saw a scientist with a tattoo. He was a neuroscientist named Bob Datta from Harvard, and he had a DNA tattoo on his shoulder, and I complimented him on it, and I said, well, I guess that makes sense because you study genes in the brain, and so it's DNA, genes, the problem solved. And he said, no, you don't understand. And he proceeded to explain to me how he had encoded his wife's initials in the DNA strand on his shoulder. And suddenly I realized that there was this whole subculture out there of very, very geeky scientific tattoos.
Yeah, and you actually have listed, you have by chapters, you got math, physics, chemistry, astronomy, earth sciences, DNA.
We've got just about every branch of science covered here, I think.
And they've got just about every kind of thing in these tattoos.
I was continually surprised. I continue to be surprised. People keep emailing me these things. I probably have over 1,000 in my email inbox.
And then rich color photos of these tattoos, and some of them are mathematical equations.
That's
they've
right.
Got, like, some of them almost have a whole thesis on there, right?
Some of them literally are a thesis. You know, people tend to, when they get a PhD, they like to celebrate. And so if they studied, say, a particular molecule, put that molecule on your body.
And some of them are very simple, but they're sort of elusive in their meaning. There's one about a trowel. And the author writes, you know, you'd think I was a biker or mason to have a trowel on here. He says, but I'm an archaeologist. That's his tool, right?
That's right. That's right. And so any other archaeologist who would look at that tattoo would know that, that they're the member of the same tribe. You know, this is a, you know, this is something that they all use all the time.
1-800-989-8255. Maybe you have a tattoo you would like to talk about or have an idea for one. So you had to basically weed out all these tattoos you couldn't use then. It must have been difficult figuring out what to keep or what not to keep.
Well, I mean, at first I had no idea how many tattoos about science there are out there. I mean, I've talked to scientists for years now, and it never occurred to me that they were hiding tattoos from me. So I took a picture of this first tattoo, this DNA tattoo from Bob Data. I put it on my blog, and I just posed a question. Does anybody else out there, any other scientist have a tattoo? And immediately I started getting flooded with these images. I started putting them on my blog, and then after a while it was clear that a book was called for. But yeah, you know, after a while you have so many that you start to need to find a way to weed through them.
Now, I know you like history of science like I do. History of science is
one
of my popular topics. Is that reflected in your tattoo collection?
Oh, big time, yes. There are all sorts of historical images. So, for example, Charles Darwin, in his notebooks in, I believe it was 1839, drew out a tree of life. This was as his theory of evolution was coming together. And so this is a really iconic image. And I got a whole bunch of tattoos of that exact reproduction of that notebook sketch on people's bodies. A whole bunch of evolutionary biologists have that particular tattoo. Other people have tattoos from Vesalius. There was a famous zoologist named Ernst Haeckel who drew beautiful pictures in the 1800s of all kinds of forms of life. Tons of people have Haeckel tattoos. So there's a lot of history in these pictures.
Talking with Carl Zimmer, author of Science, Inc., our number 1-800-989-8255, Ken in Clarksville, Tennessee. Hi, Ken. Welcome to Science Friday. Hi, Ken.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to give out my idea for a tattoo. They were giving free tattoos, but before Christmas, they were giving out tattoos to people who brought in toys. And that sort of made me think about it. And my idea for a tattoo is Euler's cyclotomic equation.
Euler's equation.
E raised to the power of I times pi plus 1 equals 0.
Yeah, this is sometimes called Euler's identity. It's a beautiful, short little equation. And guess what? There are a whole bunch of people out there with that tattoo. I think I have 3 or 4 of those in the book. It's such a beautiful equation. It's so short and yet so powerful.
All right. Ken, thanks. Are you going to get one, Ken?
Maybe next Christmas. They still have that deal going.
All right. Thanks for calling. Of course, Carl, your next book could be The Science of How You Get Rid of Tattoos.
Right.
Don't you think with all these people getting tattoos that there's going to be a point where it's not a fad anymore and people are going to be stuck? But they're so beautiful.
Well, this is sort of a self-selected group of people who are very proud of their tattoos that send them to me. I doubt that any of these people are going to get them taken off. And in fact, there are a few, you know, tenured professors, some with gray beards, who are in the book as well. You know, so you can survive to old age as a scientist and keep your tattoo intact.
Hmm. Let's go to Bill in Adrian, Michigan. Hi, Bill.
Hi, I'm a physician. And through my years in medicine, a lot of my fellow colleagues have gotten tattoos of defibrillator paddles with a line through them to indicate that they would not want advanced life support. You know, a lot of us, having been in medicine long enough and seeing the bad outcomes that happen and how people stay on ventilators for prolonged periods of time, we don't want that. So people will get a tattoo right there on their chest where they would put the paddle telling people, don't do that. So I just wanted to share that.
Sort of a permanent DNR.
Tattoo as operating instruction.
Or DNR right there, too.
All right. Thanks for that hint. 1-800-989-8255. Lots of people with ideas. Let's go to Brian in Missoula, Montana. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how's it going?
Fine. How are you?
I'm pretty good. I had a quick question about fractal tattoos.
Okay. Go ahead.
I just wanted to see if he saw any when he did the research for his book, and say how many levels of complexity he could go to, if he's ever seen, say, a Julia set to 3 levels of complexity or anything of that type.
The answer is yes. So fractals are these beautiful geometrical shapes that are sort of infinitely rugged. And the more you zoom in on them, the more detail you see on them. And so, yes, there's this particular fractal called the Julia set. I have Julia sets sent to me. The question I always have is, how detailed of a tattoo can you get if something's infinitely detailed? It might be a tricky thing for a tattoo. But, some of these tattoos are so extraordinarily detailed that I suppose you could do it.
Yeah, thanks for calling. In fact, I'm looking at what now called mass extinctions.
Yeah.
It's the whole back of somebody.
Yeah, so 65 million years ago, an asteroid slams into Earth, the dinosaurs become extinct, and so someone decided to dedicate his entire back to that cataclysmic event. And so there you go.
And also, bird-like dinosaurs had really gorgeous tattoos.
Yeah. A lot of people were really drawn to, say, Archaeopteryx, that classic bird-like dinosaur. And, there's actually a real gorgeous dinosaur called Deinonychus, maybe one of the most beautiful tattoos in the book. Unfortunately, it's got kind of reptilian scales on it. We know now that Deinonychus had feathers on it, so he's going to have to go in and get re-inked, I think.
This is like asking, the question about which child is your favorite. But I'm sure you've been asked, which is your favorite tattoo? And you probably don't have a favorite, or maybe you do.
Yeah, I page through trying to pick them, and I say, oh, well, I like that one. No, I like that one. I think, in general, I like the ones that tell you a lot about the scientist, him or herself. And some of them are funny, but some of them are quite poignant, actually. So just to give you one example, there's a neuroscientist named Lindsay Reese who has a neuron on her foot. Now, that might seem obvious to you, but there's a deeper story there. It's a particular kind of neuron that we use to send messages to our body, to move our bodies around. That's the kind of neuron that dies when people get Lou Gehrig's disease. So this woman's father actually died of Lou Gehrig's when she was 18, and that's what made her decide to become a neuroscientist. So this tattoo is really about her loss, her life, and her science all in one.
Hmm. I have to ask this question because I know people have asked me, are there tattoos or places on the body you could not put in your book that were tattooed?
Oh, yeah. There were a few where I just said, "Well, this is not going in the books." That's right. Certain full body tattoos, for example. Like, thanks,
full body tattoos.
Oh yeah,
and scientists. Did you have to be a scientist to send in stuff, or you had non-scientists sending in tattoos?
I had all sorts of people sending in tattoos. Most of the tattoos in the book happen to be from scientists, but there's some non-scientists as well. But no, I've had full-body tattoos from scientists sent to me.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to be collecting any more? You must have a lot more you could put out. Could you put a second volume out? After we hear people here today?
At the rate things are going, it could definitely come out with a second volume.
And could you think of, is there a class of tattoos you're looking for? Or is there a category that is underrepresented that you think that you'd like?
Yeah, I think I need more geology. There are a few really cool ones. Like there's a seismograph of the San Francisco earthquake.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's really cool. And there are a couple other, but there aren't enough. I need more geology, I think.
More geology. Maybe somebody's got the Grand Canyon.
They might. What I definitely do not need are tattoos of the number pi. Lots of people do that, and God bless them, but I don't need any more pictures in my email box of pi. Like, and, great. Okay, pi. Let's move on.
It's just so much. But has anybody actually you're talking about the symbol, or are you talking about the number that's been taken out to 100 digits or something like
that? Well, that's pretty cool. Actually, someone in the book has his whole arm is filled up with numbers in pi. That shows dedication.
That's right. And I guess the tattoo artists now are getting educated, too, about once they write these things on the...
Yeah, well, one thing that scientists tend to tell me is that they come into these tattoo parlors and they get into these long conversations. I mean, when you decide that you are going to have, DNA splayed across your back, you're going to be spending a lot of time with a tattoo artist. And they get to talking, and they have these long conversations about science. Yeah. And the tattoo artists that I've spoken to, they really get into it when this happens.
They become double helix experts.
Yeah.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you.
It's Science, Inc. by Carl Zimmer, forward by Mary Roach. And it's Tattoos of the Science Obsessed. Great, great picture book and great colors. And maybe you'll get some ideas, and maybe send Carl an idea for his volume 2. Thanks again.
Thank you, Ira.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to switch gears and talk about surgery with a surgeon who's written a book called Confessions of a Surgeon, The Good, the Bad, and the Complicated Life Behind the OR Doors. What happens when you're out? You're in the surgery room, and you're out. You can't see what's happening. He's going to tell us, so stay with us. We'll be right back.